This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, the 6th annual Hip Talks, a 2-minute speech-giving competition held last spring at the University of Utah. The Hinckley Institute sponsors this university-wide speech contest in conjunction with the Associated Students of the University of Utah in honor of the oratorical skills of former Utah Congressman Wayne Owens. Hip Talks is supported by the Congressman Wayne Owens Fund and seeks to foster the public speaking skills of University of Utah students. Students who participate in Hip Talks have a chance to win a $5,000 grand prize and 5 $1,000 runner-up prizes. This year, to adapt to quarantine conditions, over 80 students submitted videos for a shot at the cash prizes. We will hear from some of the best of these applicants and the top 6 prize winners at the end of the program. These speeches were recorded in April of 2020. First up is Ethan Archibald with his speech, The Bootstrap Maxim and Affordable Housing.
The saying, "I pulled myself up by my bootstraps," is often utilized by those explaining how they came from nothing to achieving something. I call this the bootstrap maxim. And while it is inspiring as it posits that one needs nothing more than hard work and dedication to be successful, it leaves far too many questions unanswered, such as, what are these bootstraps and how do we pull them? And what if mine are tattered or better yet, non-existent? I argue that in the U.S., we can look at affordable housing policy, which bolsters the low-income status of whole communities, to assess the validity or lack thereof of this bootstrap maxim. Our homes determine much more than our zip codes. They determine access to healthcare, job opportunities, and most important to my argument, quality education. Our public schools are funded through property taxes, and therefore high-income communities often have well-funded schools, and the inverse is true for low-income communities. And there's also a vast body of research that suggests a direct link between education and quality of life. In other words, those living in high-income communities often have their boots shined by their education, while those living in low-income communities have their boots stripped. This creates a recursive relationship between affordable housing and social and economic mobility. I'm suggesting an inclusionary affordable housing policy which distributes low-income housing across cities rather than packing them together. One that acts as a safety net rather than a fishing net. One that allows kids to have a quality education regardless of their parents' income. And a policy that finally distributes boots of equal quality regardless of income.
Up next is Tiffany Farfan's The New Frontline.
Hi, my name is Tiffany Farfan, and the title of my speech is The New Frontline. When I think of the front lines, I think of a soldier, armed with a weapon that will not only help them defeat our enemies, but protect them because we want them to come back home. Our soldiers deserve our greatest respect and admiration for their service in protecting our country. In the last few months, a new enemy has risen, COVID-19. It's devastated this world and thrown us all into a war that we were not ready for. But it's also created a new frontline of workers. That frontline? Nurses and doctors armed with respirators trying to keep their patients alive, all while becoming the family members of those patients because they can't have their loved ones with them. We have grocery store clerks and public transit employees. The list is endless of frontline essential workers trying to meet the needs of the American people, all while risking their lives and their families' lives. I don't know about you, but thank you does not feel like enough anymore. We need to do better. Senator Gary Peters of Michigan has proposed a bill calling for a premium pay increase of $25,000. That's equivalent to $13 an hour on top of their current pay for all frontline essential workers. Additionally, it calls for funding for protective gear and equipment because we need to not only reward them, but protect them and give them their best fighting chance against this virus. It's called the COVID-19 Heroes Fund because that's who they are, heroes. So I ask that while you're at home, safe and sound, that you think of the 4 grocery store clerks and the 41 public transit employees who have died from this virus. Of the 5,400 infected healthcare workers, a number that will continue to rise, and let's call our representatives and ask them to pledge their support for this bill, and let's show our gratitude to our new frontline. Thank you.
Up next is Maxwell Bennion and his speech, The Wielded and the Wielding.
I used to think love was waiting for me. I used to think love was something that could be found, sought after, drawn out. That if I followed the right clues, the right steps, I would find it. As if love was in hiding. A creature that would one day belong to me, a birthright. And if I kept hunting for long enough, I would come to it. But as you get wiser, not necessarily older, you learn something. Love is not hiding and waiting to be caught. It is not in this for your games, nor your sport. Love is running free in the wind. It surrounds and supports us all constantly. And if you're lucky, if you're ready, if you're humble, if you're willing, sometimes you can see it. But always, you can feel it. Not out there, beyond the horizon, but right next to you. Love is laughing. It's weeping. Love is holding everything close. Love makes the world go round. It molds us into something better. At times like these, humanity is the clay in the hands of our own love. At times like these, love takes on many names. Good news, miracles, the hard work of others. All are valid, all are love. We, at our very best, are the wielding and wielded of love. So, love. And be love, beloved. Always be love.
Up next is Bennett Blake with his speech, U.S.-China Relations Post-COVID-19.
As I speak, we are facing the greatest challenge of our times. We are warring with a relentless dictator who refuses to bargain and has corrupted and disfigured every facet of our ordinary lives. Head of microbiology at Melbourne's Monash University, Dr. Turner speculates that the virus was started in the Hunan wet market. Speculation is due in large part to the lack of surveillance and credible information coming out of China. This is symptomatic of a larger problem that has plagued U.S.-China relations long before COVID-19. In a post-corona world, the U.S. and China needs to come to a mutual understanding of our expectations on political transparency. America's consumer culture necessitates the existence of a trade partner like China. When our economies prosper, they prosper together. But when faced with crisis, the U.S. is bearing the brunt of the blow. Advisors at Deloitte forecast a 50% chance that we enter a total recession. On top of that, we are experiencing the highest unemployment rate since 1940, with less than half likely to get their jobs back after the pandemic. That's more than just a statistic. That is 17 million Americans with no means to put food on the table, no way to pay their rent, and no way to pay their medical bills. China's lack of regulations and surveillance on their wet markets demands a broader paradigm shift. China must increase their transparency not only in food markets, but environmental issues, cyber warfare, and human rights violations. Chinese hacking costs the U.S. $57 billion each year, and the inexcusable treatment of Uyghur Muslims in Chinese concentration camps disregards China's commitment to the UDHR. In a technological and data-driven world, China can no longer sweep their problems under the rug. They are a powerful nation, but they must be checked when they fail to act honestly. Once things return to normal, the U.S. needs to find a way to repair our tarnished relationship with China, but it must occur within a framework of mutual expectations.
Next is Tiffany Chan's speech, The Discrimination Pandemic.
America actually has a new disease amidst the catastrophic coronavirus. It is spreading as fast as confirmed COVID-19 cases are rising. Like the virus, it has been intensified, exacerbated, minimized, and politicized. Unfortunately, this is an added pandemic only for Asian Americans. Racism. Stigma, to be honest, is more dangerous than the virus itself. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization's Director General. Since its official launch on March 19, 2020, the Stop Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders Hate Reporting Center has received 1,135 reports in just the first 2 weeks of coronavirus discrimination from Asian Americans across the country. Different ethnicities are being racially profiled, with 61% of respondents being non-Chinese. And despite shelter-in-place policies being implemented across the nation, the number of discriminatory incidents remains high. These racially charged harassments and assaults fester because of President Trump's consistent inflammatory use of the Chinese virus that indirectly places blame on us. Words matter, and they often hold more weight when spoken by our politicians on an already racially charged American landscape. This is just the latest chapter reminiscent of a long history of anti-Asian racism in the U.S., from the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 to the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, and where we are still at now, the stereotype of Asian Americans as the perpetual foreigners. Disease, after all, fosters fear, which in turn fosters discrimination. My ethnicity is not a virus. It's a racism that will end us all.
Up next is Yan Ji with the speech, Lucky.
Hi, my name is Yan, and the title of my speech is Lucky. Do you consider yourself lucky? Do you have good looks, lots of friends, or lots of money? Or does it seem like the whole world is against you, that terrible things seem to happen no matter what you do? Is life becoming unbearable? Are you this close to giving up? Are you in desperate need of a miracle or just a quick pick-me-up? Let me tell you, the odds of a miracle are 1 in 1,000,000. But what are the odds of human life? Surely being born human is a miracle, right? Turns out it's 1 in 400 trillion. That's right, being human. Not a bug, not a tree, nor an amphibian. The chances of you being human is like finding 40 billion four-leaf clovers or winning the lottery 1,000,000 times over. Oxford Dictionary defines miracle as a surprising event not explicable by natural or scientific laws and is therefore considered a work of a divine agency. Divine agency, that's what you are. It's something to think about the next time you're down, the next time a depressive episode comes around, the next time you think you're the ugliest person to ever exist, the next time you bring that knife up to your wrist, please remember that you are not a facade. You are quite literally millions of times more than a miracle, a phenomenon, an extraordinary existence, and you already beat the odds. Thank you.
Up next is Andrea Jimenez Flores with her speech, Undocumented Immigrants Are Essential.
We are currently experiencing something we have never experienced before as COVID-19 is ravaging the earth. Thousands of people are dying and millions of people have lost their jobs. This pandemic has created a situation unlike any other, yet there are many groups of people that will be disproportionately affected and some will be excluded from aid. There are approximately 11 million undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States of America. Many of them have lost their jobs and cannot receive aid. Undocumented immigrants contribute billions of dollars to the United States' economy, and contrary to popular belief, they pay taxes. Although they are taxpayers, they do not qualify for any part of the stimulus package presented by the government. Undocumented immigrants are constantly painted as criminals who come to take advantage of the American government, yet the majority of them come to the United States of America looking for better lives and work to support their families. They are forced to flee their homes due to political injustice, violence, and poverty. They would not leave their homes and families if they had any other option. The portrayal of undocumented folks as criminals is completely false, as undocumented immigrants commit crimes at rates astronomically lower than American citizens. Undocumented immigrants are constantly dehumanized and called illegal aliens when they are human beings, and human beings cannot be illegal. The current administration adds to their dehumanization and refuses to see their contributions to the country. Yet many of these immigrants have received essential worker cards so that they can continue to work in essential services during COVID-19 and lessen their fears of being deported. Although these immigrants are essential, the government has forgotten about them when it has come to COVID-19 stimulus relief packages. It is wrong to forget about such a huge group of individuals and to deny them any sort of aid during a global pandemic simply because it is easier to dehumanize them for committing a civil infraction than to recognize that they are an essential part of the United States of America. Thank you.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we are airing the 6th annual HIP Talks, a 2-minute speech-giving competition held last spring at the University of Utah. Here is Jack Jowers with his speech, Programmed Polarization.
Things get so rhythmic when every single click becomes algorithmic. Data that decides what to feed to your feed so that all that you read reaffirms what you believe, that's absurd. But you see, we tap and we share and we scroll, digging ourselves deeper into this hole because whether you watch the show of Rachel Maddow or Ben Shapiro, you become segmented by technology into a bucket of crabs that drags you deeper into your ideology. With vicious vitriol flying and feckless faces lying, it becomes so difficult for us who are down here just trying to create a world that's more just, more free, a world where second graders don't need bullet dodging drills. Now what a world that would be. You see, we've created a system where the left or the right is more important than what's right. Meanwhile, hunger, poverty, suicide, we cannot set aside these realities. We must confront these issues together. I'm not saying that it's easy, it's not. Still, I refuse to succumb to the thought that all that we are destined for is more polarization and stagnation without solutions that improve our situation. Further, those who change or realign because of information accumulation or hold opinions that are different from their party affiliation are subject to accusation and treated like an abomination. Well, I for one admire those who change, those who grow, those who don't just go with the flow, because where we need to go is a place where we listen, and listen not just to catch our opponent slipping, but really listen to understand, to find common ground upon which we can stand, but we can't listen if we keep shouting. We become so quick to defend and riposte that we forget that what really matters the most is not whether our opinions are right or are wrong, but whether the world we are creating allows us to move on, forward, to a world that is brighter and less divided. And that's a future worth fighting for, a future where we're united.
Here is Ryan Nipple with his speech, Cops and Robbers.
You are walking down the street, minding your own business, when an armed man stops you and orders you to give him all your money. Fearing for your life, you give in and empty your wallet. You've just been robbed. Not by a man in a ski mask and a black hoodie, but a blue uniform and a badge. Police officers utilize the tactic known as civil asset forfeiture to perform robberies just like this all across America, to the tune of over $5 billion a year, greater than the amount stolen by actual burglars. In 42 U.S. states, including Utah, police can seize cash, cars, even houses, based only on the suspicion that they were used in a crime, without ever convicting their owner of a crime, and in 80% of cases, without ever even filing charges against the owner of the property. And if you're saying to yourself, hey, this seems like a gross violation of my constitutional rights, you'd be right. And 72-year-old South Carolina resident Ella Bromell would be inclined to agree with you. This is because she has spent the last 10 years of her life fighting aggressive police seizure efforts against her home due to small-time drug deals that took place on her property without her knowledge while she was asleep. In 2000, Utah voters overwhelmingly approved a ballot initiative that placed limitations on forfeiture, and revenues from the practice decreased to $0 by 2003. In 2004, Utah legislators overturned the reforms. Today, Utah ranks 12th in the nation for asset seizure revenues. It's taken you less than 2 minutes to realize why civil asset forfeiture turns cops into robbers. Why has it taken our lawmakers 20 years?
Up next is Nico Krager with his speech, "If My Parents Weren't Robots, They Would Know I Have a Boyfriend."
If my parents weren't robots, they would know I have a boyfriend. Society told my sweet parents to teach me about getting good grades, being considerate to girls, color matching my clothes, and knowing not to point at strangers in public. They gave me my own personal Garden of Eden. So what happens when I figure out that there's more outside of the garden? In middle school, Harrison taught me about sex at the bus stop. In high school, Keegan told me that weed makes anything more fun. And by senior year, I realized that Eric, the kid that sat in front of me in science class, had more sex appeal than the girl I was taking to prom. With each new discovery, I isolated myself farther and farther from my parents because they didn't open a line of communication from the beginning. Now, I just want to be able to laugh about terrible first dates with them, cry about the effects of the current coronavirus, and fight about how Jojo Rabbit should have one best picture instead of Parasite. But even these trivial things seem to be too hard to discuss. So what do I do now? While my parents wonder why I don't bring girls home, I have a boyfriend that knows my friends, likes watching TV with me, and sleeps over at my place on the weekends. My parents thought that sheltering me while I was young would be the best way to raise me, but instead, I needed an understanding of reality and an emotional support system that I could trust. So here's the lesson. If you have kids, please say shit at the dinner table now and again. Talk about how sex has helped your relationship. Spill the gossip about your siblings and talk about how horrible your job is. Then maybe they won't have to write a speech about your parenting skills for cathartic release.
Here is Vivian Lee with the speech, "Standing in Solidarity, An Important Lesson from COVID-19.
The coronavirus pandemic has taken the world by surprise. Many of us weren't expecting all of this to change. For us Asian Americans, this moment includes not only the fear of getting sick, but also the fear of leaving our homes, only to hear vicious lines like, "Go back to your country." This increased xenophobic rhetoric and racism towards Asians and Asian Americans is enraging. Our situation has recently become amplified. In the lives of most Black and Brown people, institutionalized racism is simply a reality, which is why now is such a crucial time for Asians to support Black and Brown power during this pandemic and after. As the Asian population has become the target of this new hate, others have stood to help by defending, taking a stance, and clearing up misinformation, debunking that this is the Chinese virus or that it's because Asians eat bad crazy food. People of color all over have shown the importance of race-based intersectionality during this global pandemic, and we need to make sure that we hold on to this lesson. Many members of our own university have shown their solidarity with the Asian community by taking part in the Wash the Hate campaign on social media. But we still have such a long way to go to make our campus and communities safer and more inclusive for all people of color. Whether it's calling out Trump's policies of putting kids in cages or standing in protest against police brutality aimed at Black bodies, we live in a world where it no longer makes any sense for our activism to only focus on issues that directly relate to our personal and individual identities. If there's one thing COVID-19 is teaching us, it's that our lives depend on collective and collaborative action. Together.
Here is Tressa Marr with their speech, "Teeth Tell Tales."
Teeth tell our stories. Your first permanent molar bears the timestamp of your birth. And when you die, it's what will remain of you the longest. It's what a forensic specialist would use to identify you. And teeth tell our history of wealth inequality and of exploitation. As sugar became more prevalent among the affluent during colonization, there was a huge market that was created for human teeth to replace the teeth that were rotting in the heads of the wealthy. These could come from the dead, from graveyards and battlefields, or they could come from the living, where in order to attempt tooth transplants, they were ripped from the heads of the poor and enslaved people without anesthetic. George Washington himself purchased teeth from an enslaved person in order to attempt a tooth transplant. And teeth also tell our story of inequality today. Even if people can afford medical insurance, they often can't afford dental. And though Medicaid, in theory, covers dental, in all practicality, so few dentists are actually enrolled in Medicaid that access to dental care under Medicaid is scarce. And it kills. People go to the ER for toothaches all the time, and they die of sepsis. And if you've never had a toothache, consider yourself lucky, because many people describe it as the worst pain imaginable or the worst physical pain they've ever endured. And even when it's not fatal, teeth are so wrapped up in our American ideas of what is beautiful and who is respectable and who is employable. And many people have laughter and smiling tainted or taken from them from the shame of showing their bad teeth. I think about teeth a lot because I believe my own story is written there. After a year of PTSD-fueled nightmares, I have ground my teeth jagged. And now when I look in the mirror, I'm less likely to see the smile that resembles my mother's and much more likely to remember jaw aches and constant terror. It doesn't have to be like this, though. Teeth are the sites of pain and joy, but also inequality and identity. But we should all have the right to smile painlessly and joyfully.
Up next is Tammy Reck with the speech, Protecting the Invisible.
We all have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic in some way, but for children under 5, the impact is even more substantial. Even though they seem to be less susceptible to the coronavirus, they are still the most vulnerable and marginalized members of our society. Pediatricians warn a surge in child abuse cases during stressful times, as they observe an increase in infant injuries and deaths from abusive head trauma during the 2008 recession. Also, 1 in 15 children in the U.S. will be exposed to intimate partner violence. And as of April 9th, the Utah County 911 dispatch reported a 75% increase in domestic violence calls. So while many might be able to enjoy quarantine as a family, for many children, staying at home means they can get away from their abuser. 93% of child abuse reported cases come from sources other than the parents. So if children are not being seen outside of the home, they will most likely stay in a dangerous situation for a longer period of time. This is important because the first 5 years of life have a lasting impact. 90% of brain development happens during that time. So children rely on us adults to help them grow and keep them safe. So let's be better neighbors and through acts of service, help parents ease their stress. Let's share information on emotional health and domestic violence hotlines. Let's support early childhood programs such as Early Head Start that connects parents to resources and are doing virtual check-ins with families. Children's rights are human rights. It is our responsibility as a society to protect children from all forms of abuse.
Up next is Alvin Song with Social Heroin.
My speech today is called Social Heroin. It is no question that our daily routines are firmly rooted and manipulated by this addiction. We know that it doesn't bring us joy. We also know that it brings us envy, jealousy, and hatred. And yet we willingly inject this poison into our bodies because we can't seem to find a better way of nurturing our own self-worth. We constantly seek its seemingly innocent feedback mechanism for validation that shows more harm than good. It is a blatant, persistent addiction, one that our world seems to find normal. It is so ingrained in our culture that we don't even remember a time without it. I call this the modern social heroine. Injecting it is a daily sacrifice of our personal happiness and self-worth for the sake of being connected. It all begins the same. We create a new account with the intention of staying connected to our friends and family. We then progress to minor dosages, checking in on some old high school friends, maybe checking some photos of an old high school crush. We then up that dosage. We post our own pictures and content with the underlying intentions of showing off and seeking validation. We then refresh and refresh and refresh, each time becoming less happier than the next, hoping to see more likes, hearts, and positive comments. Because for some reason, we have now decided that this has become our primary source of happiness and meaning. When we talk about mental health, we mention fears of loneliness, depression, and psychotic drugs, and yet we willingly ignore this injection of social heroin in our daily lives. Social media is this social heroin, and you are worth way more than the happiness it may give you.
Here is Brianna Skaggs with the speech, Saving Graduation.
Graduating seniors, congratulations. We'll celebrate on Zoom. The next generation of high school and college graduates have lost before they've even had a chance to start. Graduation is a time to celebrate achievement, a rite of passage that most will lose this year due to COVID-19. But graduation symbolizes the transition from one phase of life to another. This year, that moment won't happen. There's more our community can do to give graduates their moment. Sure, it can't happen in the traditional sense due to the importance of flattening the curve, but creativity and problem solving don't stop because we're at home. I propose that high schools, colleges, and universities create a drive-in movie graduation. Potential location for these events are football fields, a community park, or local drive-in movie theater if available. The model is simple. First, schools ask graduates to submit videos, baby pictures, and senior pictures to include in a commencement-style slideshow. 2, speakers pre-record their speeches and submit to a graduation video coordinator to edit the ceremony together. 3, the graduation video with speakers, students, and administrators would go live on the drive-in screen. 4, cars can be decorated and horns can honk just like a cheering crowd. The only rule is everyone must stay in their car with the people they're already quarantined with. The video content can be as creative as the schools want, and for larger schools, the event can be broken down to smaller groups of graduates spread over a week of drive-in graduations. A drive-in graduation is not traditional, but neither is our world. Yes, we're in a vulnerable place, but rites of passages exist for a reason. We need to celebrate the wins in life. We need to still celebrate the rites of passages for the 2020 graduating class.
Up next is Rachel Westman with the speech, The Secret Syrup to Success.
Do you do the best you can? Or do you just do enough? My mom is addicted to Diet Coke. And despite having a soda fountain in our basement, she will often drive 3 miles to the nearest McDonald's because she believes the Diet Coke there tastes better. It turns out this is a theme among all of McDonald's sodas. Tons of people actually believe that Coca-Cola sells McDonald's secret syrup that no one else can get. A Reader's Digest article taught me, however, that McDonald's actually does 4 things to make their soda taste better. First, they order their syrup in metal canisters rather than the boxes that they usually come in. Second, they chill those canisters so that the syrup goes into the machine already cold. Third, they use cold filtered water, which is better for carbonation. And finally, they give it to you in a thicker straw. Now, all of this may seem a little unnecessary or over the top for such a cheap product, but people agree that McDonald's soda tastes better. That drives in customers because no one else is willing to go above and beyond like they do. You might wonder what this has to do with you. I could name countless successful people: Serena Williams and Michael Jordan, Tim Cook and Jeff Bezos, the list really goes on. But the thing is, none of these people had any more skill, more money, more talent to start off with than you do. There's no secret syrup. They just made choices to go above and beyond what most people are willing to do. And that's how they've created success. So let me ask you again. Do you do the best you can? Or do you just do enough?
Here is Jenna Wiseman with her speech, I'd Vote for You.
I have a question for you. How do we, the United States, elect a woman head of state? Well, we could ask the UK or Iceland, Israel or South Korea or Liberia. There are dozens of countries we could ask, actually, but we can't seem to figure out the answer here. Why? Well, they say, who is they? I have a feeling it might be some of you. Well, I would vote for a woman, but America just isn't ready for a woman president, so I worry she's not electable. I would vote for her, but... But what? Why isn't she electable? Multiple studies show that when women run at the same rates as men, they win at the same rates as men. But Trump is in office, they say. It's such an inconvenient time to take the risk of electing a woman. But that's what you said 4 years ago. There are unprecedented things happening that quite frankly scare me. But in 4 years, you will once again say it's an inconvenient time to elect a woman and not to worry that her time is just around the corner in 4 more years. I take it personally every time. It's like my sisters and I become the inconvenient risks that women who run for president are deemed to be. People are surprised I take it so seriously. They try to cheer me up by saying, well, I would vote for you, or you'll be the one who breaks the glass ceiling, but I don't know what's supposed to be encouraging about bearing the sole responsibility of becoming an electable woman. Plus, I don't think they'd vote for me. They might want to, but... I asked you at the beginning how we elect a woman president. The answer is simple. Stop making excuses and vote for her. It's as convenient a time now as ever. Thank you.
Here is David Witt with his speech, All Because We Were Born in the Right Place.
How do you tell a story that you can't imagine unless you see it with your own eyes? And I wasn't even the one living it, only observing. I recently returned from an internship in Lesbos, Greece, helping at Moria Refugee Camp, an area designed for 3,000 people, now crammed with nearly 25,000 asylum seekers. These are just normal people wanting to live normal lives with basic human rights, broken from being forced to leave their homes, their families, and everything that they love, hoping for a better future, only to get here in Europe, for God's sake, to this camp, which unfortunately isn't the only one of its kind. I know I can get a hot shower and dry clothes after being soaked in the rain. I know I can get at least one pair of underwear or socks. I know I can get food whenever I'm hungry without waiting in line all day or my portions being rationed. I know I can get a blanket or turn up the heater when the nights drop below freezing. I know I can still talk with my family and friends. I know I can return to my city without the fear of death. With political tensions and uncertainty rising, ultimately forcing my organization to be evacuated from the island, I asked the man who was yelling and cursing at me and physically harassing a group of refugee women, where is the humanity? You and I are the humanity. Our small acts, wherever we are, whatever local or global cause we contribute to, will make life for at least one person for one more day just a little bit better. We are very privileged to be able to hold up a blue U.S. passport, to be able to return to the safety, security, and comfort of our home. I don't know why we were born, where we were, with what we have, but I know I must pay it forward.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, we hear from the prize winners of this year's 6th annual Hip Talk speech competition. 4 runners-up and the staff favorite were awarded $1,000 each, with the grand prize of $5,000 given to the top speech. Up next is runner-up Allie Hill with her speech, The Truth Is.
From Allie, you look good, to Allie, you look great, to Allie, you're so skinny, I wish I could look that way. I wrap fingers around my wrists. I feel the muscles in my thighs. Then I look into the mirror, and finally, I cry. I stare sleepless at black ceilings. I drink coffee by the pot. You know, it turns out being skinny isn't what I thought. According to the National Eating Disorder Association, each year in the United States, nearly 30 million people suffer from eating disorders. Of those at the highest risk are college students. Academic and financial stress, newfound self-reliance, and new relationships are among the many risk factors that make our demographic susceptible. Yet despite the prevalence of these mental illnesses in our own community, understanding and response remain limited. Part of the problem is that we have a single narrative about eating disorders. We tend to imagine a young, emaciated girl who refuses to eat. But the truth is much more complex. While there are risk factors that we can look for, we tend to dismiss the fact that one in four sufferers are males, that according to the Mayo Clinic, 35% of anorexia patients have a history of obesity, and that 25% of college athletes exhibit symptoms at a subclinical level. The truth is that eating disorders do not discriminate. Yet, this response on college campuses remains limited, whereas in a national survey, only 22% of college students reported that their university had an eating disorder screening available, and only 43% reported that their university offered therapy sessions for body image issues. The truth is that eating disorders are the deadliest mental illness. So while the world suffers from a global pandemic, the epidemic plaguing our mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, partners, and friends is hidden behind bathroom doors and claims of health and fitness. I know, because I lived off of 500 calories a day for months, until I came to realize that life is more important. Thank you.
Up next is runner-up Stephanie Morgan with the speech, The Secret Liberal Agenda in Schools.
I wanted to become a teacher for one reason, to indoctrinate your youth with liberal propaganda. After I received my teacher's license, I was instructed to enter the back door of Planned Parenthood. There, I was met with a gaggle of women, all wearing pink pussy hats. They parted as their leader slithered into the room. Nancy Pelosi. Nancy drew out a welfare check from her pocket. The secret liberal agenda was written discreetly on the back. What does it say? Take everyone's guns and turn them into gay commies? Nancy was bewildered. No, we want safe schools where everyone is respected and they have what they need to work hard and succeed. Pushing aside my embarrassment, I brazenly swore to infiltrate the curriculum of our schools. As I hurried down the street, one by one, rednecks toting AK-47s and bazookas crept up beside me until I was encircled. They grabbed me and tossed me into a Ford truck, and with a cough of black smoke, the truck jostled all the way to a megachurch. I was pushed into a chair, and my hands were zip tied to the arms, and I looked up into the eyes of George W. Bush. George ambled towards me and whipped out a huge Bible. If we ain't gonna get the liberal agenda out of you, we're gonna force the conservative agenda on you. And he began to read. Number one, love thy neighbor. Wait a minute, this sounds like the liberal agenda of mutual respect. Number two, reap what you sow. Again, hard work and success. Number three, peace on earth. Like, safe schools? It was in that moment that I realized the liberal and conservative agendas weren't that different after all. Do you know what this means? The liberal agenda has infiltrated the Bible. Victory!
Up next is runner-up Wendy Joseph with her speech, The Real Virus.
I find it unnerving how a problem never becomes a crisis until it is personal. Wuhan, China was battling the coronavirus for nearly 2 months. Meanwhile, a White House official called it the Kung Flu. But on February 24th, when the market dropped by 3.5%, half of its typical yearly decline in one day, then it was serious. That same ignorance is mirrored by spring breakers tanning on the beaches of Miami and captioning their Instagram posts, "We'll all get through this." And maybe we do. And if we do, maybe we're all the better for it. Or maybe if business as usual resumes by November, we will be back to our vices by Christmas. It is only a crisis if it is personal, and after that, a memory that rarely becomes a lesson. Columbine was a crisis, as was Sandy Hook, and ISIS, and Ebola, and the election, and the recession, and the impeachment, and Amazon, and Australia, and now they're all just mere moments in time simply because we are bred to either bleed out our problems or band-aid our wounds. It is the global pandemic of apathy that remains uncured, and until it is, it will not make much of a difference when the next shooting will be, how long entire continents burn, who is elected president, and if they'll be impeached, whether or not the stock market crashes, or how long we stay home. Because unless we learn to care about a crisis before it directly affects us, we could write all of the policies, plant all of the trees, and save our economy, be hand in hand, face to face, and social, but distant.
Up next is runner-up Madeline Lamaze with their speech, More Than Their Words.
Woman, cockroach, slave, black, refugee, criminal, illiterate, failure. These words have been used to taint my self-esteem and potential. Whether done intentionally or ignorantly, they've been used to propel me to believe that maybe, just maybe, being black, a woman, an orphan, and now a refugee is a curse. So at times I gave in. I let them define me. I let government leaders, rebels, peers, poverty, war, and society tell me who they think I am. And that rendered me powerless. But during these long, self-destructive moments, they were small but powerful ones, where I looked at myself and saw a strong and vigorous human who is capable of any extraordinary thing that anyone else in any other circumstance is capable of. I realized that I can be whoever I aspire to be, whether that's a mother, a leader, an intellect. I can. You can. Soon, I can declare myself a graduate of one of the top-tier institutions in the world's most powerful nation. Yes, I may have been born in circumstances that leads the world to think of me as the tail, but I'm forging a path that compels the same world to think of me as the head. Maybe yesterday was a massacre, today a defeat, but tomorrow is victory. I've learned that sometimes you have to submit, cry, run before you can live, fight, overcome, lead, and soar. Thank you.
Up next is Benjamin Murzok, who was chosen as the staff favorite with his speech, Reviving EMS.
Imagine that you are with your family in Morgan County, Utah, celebrating Easter. Unfortunately, one of your family members develops severe left shoulder and jaw pain. And so you call 911, and therefore you and your family now expect for there to be an advanced life support provider, such as myself, to arrive in a vehicle that is well equipped to manage their emergency. However, because you are in a rural location, that is not guaranteed. It is not guaranteed that the ambulance will arrive in time for their medical emergency, or that the medical provider has the expertise or training that they deserve. This is an epidemic that is plaguing all of EMS in all of America. And there are two simple policy changes that you can advocate for that will make a difference. One is government sponsorship and professionalization. Government sponsorship would ensure that every American has a fighting chance in those critical moments, and that they have access to the preventative measures that EMS can provide. This is a basic medical necessity that every American deserves. And professionalization. This would ensure that all EMS professionals are well-educated, well-trained to perform the skills and maneuvers and procedures that are critical and life-saving to you and our patients. Professionalization would also allow for further research and development to occur in this field. So that way, the quality of care that you, your family member who is experiencing a medical emergency, and the public can all benefit from. Please help us revive you by reviving EMS. Thank you.
Finally, here is our grand prize winner and recipient of the $5,000 cash prize, Noah Hughes, with his speech, Like Father, Like.
I don't want to become like my pops. Gut bursting out or outbursts around the clock, not even wearing the watch, just up at crack of dawn, workaholic, and then alcoholic, putting the bottle down, not just my mom. I don't want to be like dad, like damn, I see his reflection in my mirror and I shake it off every chance. I don't want to look like him, that's why I wear my hair the length of these strands. What good is looking like a man if that's not how you act? I don't want to be like my father, quick to anger, but then quicker to push it farther. Wrath belt from his pants whack. I want to fight even harder, but I tried to take it without a sound because I see the way the screams make my mom hurt. I don't want to become like my old man, go on to scold my kid with the voice of both hands. I want to be the hugging type, I'm like him, who only in his shame would he hold me and pat my back. Perhaps he was scared I would snitch to my peers and my teachers in class, so he told me to keep secrets. Well, I'm scared to become my pops. I see his habits start to form, I'm looking for me, but I've been lost. I hide my feelings and mask the tears, but then no one hears the gun cock barrel pressed in my head. I either end up dead or I end up like him. Stop, I'm scared to end up like him. But lately, I've been hitting walls with the ball fist. I've been more and more withdrawn from a therapist. I keep it all bottled up and then shot my lungs out of my girlfriend. I'm scared to see my decline begin. I'm scared to see my past win. I'm scared to see me beat my kid. I'm scared to see me lose my shit. I don't want to be like him. I don't want to be like him. I don't want to be like him. I don't want to be like him.
That's our show this week. Congratulations to all the University of Utah students who participated and to the winners of the 6th annual Hip Talks. If you'd like to hear the previous Hip Talk competitions, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.